Greetings and welcome to Flanagan's Ecologic. I am your host, Ted Flanagan, and today I'm joined by Sherry Smith. She was the founder and CEO of the Indigenized Energy Initiative, a nonprofit focused on eradicating energy poverty in Indigenous communities. That's now been renamed. It's now the Alliance for Tribal Clean Energy. She has an impressive career in clean energy, and now she's making waves on behalf of Indigenous people. Delighted to have her on the podcast today. Hey, Sherry, welcome to the podcast. How are you doing today?
I am wonderful, Ted. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, you're kind to take the time out of your busy schedule. Where just physically are you in Narragansett, Rhode Island, as we speak?
I am calling in from the checkerboarded Narragansett Reservation in Charlestown, Rhode Island. We live on a piece of fee land that was sold to the previous owners of this house by the tribe.
Wow. Okay. So this tribal land all throughout New England. I mean, I think you were born and raised up in, is it Northern Maine?
I was born and raised in the Boston area. My dad and his family are Northern Maine, mixed. I'm descended through both of my parents, actually, but more closely through my dad's side, from the Mi'kmaq Nation of Northern Maine and the Canadian Maritimes. There's over 20 bands of Mi'kmaq and Cape Breton and Nova Scotia, and that's where my native and Scottish and French relatives all met and mingled.
So interesting. Now, did you think at all along when you were going to college and your early steps that you would be working on tribal issues?
Not at all. Nope.
Not at all.
Not at all. In my family, as is the case in a lot of mixed European Indigenous families, we were colonized. The tribes on the East Coast were colonized really early. The hereditary chief that I descend from was baptized Catholic in 1605. So the assimilation and intermingling of the cultures happened really early on the East Coast. And so while my great-great-grandmother was Mi'kmaq and my great-great-grandfather was Scottish, and then we marriages into with French families mixed with Penobscot, it was very mixed. But we were raised to not talk about our Indigenous heritage because of the discrimination that our elders had faced. They didn't want, we suddenly were white passing in this, generation of my dad, for example, and we weren't allowed to talk about it because bad things happened when people knew that you were Indigenous. So I grew up
interesting,
very yearning to know more. And as I got older, and became an adult, and I would travel to Maine and dig around in the history and the genealogy, and I would been to Canada and try and to find the origins of our Indigenous side. That met with some consternation, from my dad and my grandma especially. They're like, "What are you doing?" And so it was always in my mind. And but then it wasn't until after I had been in the renewables industry for like the better part of two decades that I had the opportunity to visit tribes in Indian country, in the plains and the Great Plains. And when I saw firsthand the poverty and the extreme toll that not a lack of access to energy takes on people on reservations right now, but that is a problem. 14% of Native households don't have electricity in our country, but it was more the energy poverty being caused because of a lack of ability to pay for their energy because of the extreme costs of energy in Indian country. And we can get into that. There's discriminatory rate practices and things that we're trying to rectify now that are a cause of this. And so when you see this, what, you know, if I were to explain this place to you, you would think that I was talking about a third world developing nation, when in fact I'm describing many hundreds of Native communities in our country in the 21st century. And when I saw that, and I realized that my whole background in clean energy and in education and workforce, I had a network, I had knowledge, and I could bring this to bear on this problem. I couldn't turn away. I brought the idea actually to Elon. I was at Tesla at the time, and I brought the idea to him. We were running projects. I took the opportunity to run some demonstration projects on tribal lands through our foundation that was at called Give Power, that was Solar Cities Foundation. And we had great success in tribal communities in Montana adopting clean energy because of these demonstration projects and demystifying it for these communities who had, you know, only heard about it on television. And when I brought the idea for basically what now is our organization to Elon and said, you know, we can do this, and the old cliche, we can do good and we can do well at the same time. There's a way that we could make a modest profit and help so many tribal communities. And he didn't like that idea at all. And so
is that when you formed indigenous or indigenized energy initiative? It was both.
That was when we formed Covenant Tribal Solar Initiative. And I, you know, bootstrapped that. We merged with Tesla. Solar City merged with Tesla. I continued to work at Tesla. And then there was a tipping point where I said, if I don't invest myself in this full time, it's not going to get done. So I lived off my Tesla stock for 6 years, and with a team of folks who were, you know, like-minded, we stood up this covenant. And then we were being confused with Christian-based organizations. And Chief Henry Red Cloud of Oglala Lakota Hereditary Chief, who is on our advisory board, he asked, why did you call the organization Covenant? And I said, well, it's in reference to the sacred covenants that tribes have to protect and preserve Mother Earth. And one of his right hand men says, oh, we thought you were holy roller solar.
But now, what was the purpose of that organization? Were you going to be consulting? Were you going to be trying to get grants and funnel them to the tribes? What was the business model or the business case there?
So back then, it was demonstration projects. It was getting philanthropy to help us fund projects to demonstrate the literal and figurative power of clean energy to transform communities. When you bring solar to a household that is stricken by poverty, and you eliminate, you know, some of these bills in Indian country in the wintertime, especially, or even in the summer with cooling, they're upwards of $800,000 for small homes. And so these are poorly built HUD houses that have little or no insulation, really inefficient electric resistance heaters. And in the dead of winter, when it's freezing cold, they can't afford to pay more than a month's worth of heat, if that. And then it's compounded by the fact that the utilities will come in and the co-ops will shut power off. And this is the deeper problem here that we were addressing. The reason why we even started this was because in those circumstances, people can't afford the reconnect fees of $1,000 that the co-ops want. And so they end up resorting to burning things indoors to keep warm, which is not safe and not healthy. And when they run out of things to burn indoors to keep warm, many people die of exposure in their own homes, on reservations all across the plains. And that is just unacceptable, right? So when you introduce solar into a home that is stricken by poverty like that, they're not, you know, using the avoided cost pays for things like medicine and better food and clothing for children. And many homes are multi-generational, where you have grandparents taking care of dozens of grandkids. And so we were using solar demonstration projects on the homes of tribal elders, mostly, to demonstrate to the communities that this is a technology that is not hocus pocus, like many feel, and that it can it's the cheapest form of, you know, new electricity generation. And that's all news to folks that are living, you know, in these poverty stricken conditions and worried about survival every day. So that's how we started. And then over the course of the last, you know, 5-6 years, what's happened is that tribes have become very sophisticated in their knowledge about the technologies that are out there. They just don't have the financial wherewithal, many of them, or the technical and administrative capacity to even know where to turn for this funding. So that's where we came in. And with the IRA, we crossed another threshold, and that's what's going on right now. I know you were interested to learn about how that is impacting Indian country.
Yeah, well, I'm just curious, would those demonstrations then lead to, I mean, it's almost like you're teeing up all the old Solar City model or the Sunrun model, the Tesla, you know, the residential solar leasing model that they have. Is that available on the reservations? It seems like, no, with those really high avoided costs, that they would be it would be very beneficial to have that third party financing.
It's actually, they're not available. And the reason primarily is, you know, on reservations. Now, we're not talking about, so when I speak about reservations and that we were working on, it's not, you know, Agua Caliente, where everybody gets a per capita check with six figures in it every year, or even every month. These are tribes that don't have commerce. They don't have casino revenue. They don't have, you know, any kind of enterprises to speak of, because of where they're located, mostly far from major thoroughfares of commerce, and in these, you know, godforsaken corners of state where nothing grows and there's no agriculture, and, you know, you don't have a lot of opportunity for jobs and economic development, period. So the typical models for solar, no solar company, this is why Elon said no, right? Most folks in those regions, they don't have a credit score, or they don't have credit, or they don't have jobs that can meet the requirements of these loans, these PPAs, or leases. So it's, most tribal communities out there are not markets for conventional solar companies. Right. So the way we were approaching it was, our original thought was to create a model where we would use, and we did this on the Northern Cheyenne Reservation, where we secured a grant to build, you know, 15 residential solar systems, three small community size systems, and a 1 megawatt array. And the idea is to build it and have the solar fund go into a fund, a revolving fund, that it would eventually become solvent, and then allow the tribes to reinvest in more solar. In the model that we created for the Northern Cheyenne, it was kind of like a PPA, but the tribe has an LLC, which is the owner of the solar. And so the resident and the tribe split the benefit 50-50. So 50% goes into an account that the tribe maintains to invest in more solar, and 50% of the savings go to the the homeowner or the renter who has the ground mounted 10 kilowatt array on their land.
Yeah.
And this is under development as we speak. Like those systems are being built right now. So it remains to be seen if it's, I mean, it pencils, right? It works on paper, but in tribal communities, nothing is a given. I mean, nothing is a given in any community, but especially in tribal communities where crises and trauma kind of rule. Yeah. So that was the original.
Let me see then if I get the, and then the flow. So you went from Covenant Tribal Solar Initiative to Indigenized Energy Initiative, and now it's the Alliance for Tribal Clean Energy. Do I have the chronology right, or the sequence correct?
Yeah, there's one more stop in there. So without getting too political or in detail, we changed the name from Covenant to Indigenized because of the confusion. Yeah. And then one of the folks that I had hired who worked with us, he had been using the term indigenized for a grassroots org in his community. And so when he left the org, he wanted to kind of take that word back. And so we said, okay, cool. So we started using I became indigenous instead of indigenized. But because of the literal outcry from tribes since the passing of the IRA, we have, with the support of philanthropy and our federal colleagues and partners and our other NGO partners, we have stood up the alliance. It is exactly, we believe, what is needed at this point. And it became crystal clear over the last 6 months how we could best serve tribes. And so the evolution, it was slow at first, and then the last 6 months have been like just a whirlwind.
Let's break it, Sherry. Let's break it down a little bit. Let's talk about first, what is the IRA providing, and then what is your alliance? I think you've got multiple programs that you're operating now. But first, start with what is the IRA providing? And I know that out here in California, you know, the California Energy Commission has been you know, giving grants and preferential access to grants for some years. And now the IRA, I think, is doing the same thing, right?
Well, yeah, the IRA is a big deal, right? So in August of 2022, the House passed HR 5376, the Inflation Reduction Act, and it was touted as the most significant climate bill in US history. And it's far from an environmentalist's ideal. As you know, there's a lot of compromises in there, including carve outs for the oil and gas industries, and intended to garner the support of Senator Manchin. But it does allow our government to do what climate scientists have been advising for several decades, right? To make a serious investment in decarbonizing our energy sector. And it really incentivizes the transition from extractive and exploitive fossil fueled energy to clean and regenerative energy sources. And the question for tribes does it encourage a just transition? I myself and my team, we're more than cautiously optimistic. The IRA includes more than $272 million in climate and energy investments tailored for tribes and administered by the BIA, by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And this funding is earmarked for climate resiliency efforts, for fish hatcheries and drought mitigation programs in tribal communities. It also authorizes over $150 million for a new program to electrify homes that don't have electricity. As we were saying earlier, it's 14%, right? And to improve energy efficiency in homes and tribal buildings. 145-ish million of that funding is being provided directly to tribes, and then BIA takes the rest of that for administration, and the money's to be spent over 10 years. The other thing that the bill did that is so encouraging is that it expanded the U.S. Department of Energy tribal programs. and it authorized more than 75 million in loans to tribes for energy development. And then the loan guarantee program and our, you know, Jigar Shah and Matt Ferguson at DOE, like we've grown up together in this industry. And, you know, now we have gray hair and we have this, we're working together on this beautiful loan guarantee program, which it expanded from 2 billion to 20 billion. And the team at DOE, at the Office of Indian Energy Policy and Programs, Wahela Johns and her team, David Conrad and Tommy Jones and, you know, her whole team, they have really made a concerted effort to listen to their constituents and advocated for this much needed legislation. I know you've heard about, you know, there's a lot of talk about direct pay, and among the most impactful provisions of this bill is the two tax rules, direct pay and the transferable credits. And you're familiar with that, right?
Well, yeah, but why don't you explain it for our listeners?
Sure. So under the direct pay provision, tribes can elect to treat the amount of certain specific credits as a prior payment of tax, which then allows entities with little or no tax liability, nonprofits and like tribes, to accelerate the utilization of these credits. So this provision is a game changer for tribes. So it's equivalent. It's like taking the ITC and you get they get 30%. Immediately, just as an equivalent to the ITC right off the bat. And then there are adders. So it is possible, feasible for certain tribes in certain geographies to actually achieve a credit of 70%. So you start with that 30% equivalent to the ITC off the bat. You get a 10% adder for building on tribal lands. You get another 10% adder for using predominantly US-made gear. You get another 10% for building in what's called a clean energy zone, which is basically where fossil fuel development has abandoned the region and left people jobless. There's another 10% for establishing paying prevailing wage and establishing apprenticeship programs. So there's your potential for 70%. So when this does a few things, you know, it makes renewable energy development on tribal lands exponentially more beneficial. And with tribal lands holding enough potential to power the entire country, bypassing these traditional tax equity structures and utilizing that 20 building and funding from the Tribal Energy Loan Guarantee Program really has the potential to unlock this beneficial cycle of self-determined capacity building within the tribes and will hopefully lead to a liberation from federal dependency. That's what the alliance is about, is helping the tribes, supporting them as they build their own capacity to identify which funding streams are best for them, apply them, bridge the gap in any financing, and to build these projects by Native people for Native people and employ Native people wherever possible.
How exciting. That's fantastic. And I really appreciate your description of how tribes can achieve 70% tax credits and how wonderful you achieve the 70% and then take the next 30% in a loan with a loan guarantee from the federal government. That's pretty, it sounds very pivotal. So what is the biggest challenge right now, Sherry, in all of this for you and for the tribes?
Well, some Native communities have the technical expertise and capacity. Yeah. Being in this business, Ted, you understand, you know, the knowledge and the skill sets and the staff that, whether it be a municipality, a school district, or a tribal nation needs in order to engage in this level of development that's really going to move the needle. Some communities have that, but the majority do not. And so without the expertise and the capacity building support of technical, financial, policy, and workforce development experts and training experts, even the most well-funded projects run the risk of failure. So even, you know, and we've seen it time and time and time again, where tribes have applied for federal funding and then failed to execute. And then they end up owing hundreds of thousands of dollars to the government because they didn't have the capacity. On the other side, they rely on developers that promise them the world. Oh, we'll write the grants for you. And, you know, we'll build this project and, you know, we'll give you cents on the acre for your land. And then all of the value of those systems goes off res. Yeah. So yeah, we're the antidote to that.
Yeah. Yeah. So the technical capacity is really what you're bringing. And then are you reaching out to the tribes, or are they coming to you? How does that, is it a little bit of both?
We haven't had to reach out to tribes. They are calling. Okay. It has been, so since the IRA, the influx of inquiries has been steady since the bill was passed last August. We hosted a tribal energy equity summit at the end of May. And that's where we announced that with our philanthropic funders, with the MacArthur Foundation, the Energy Foundation, and others, that we were standing up the alliance. In the 5-6 weeks since that summit, we've engaged officially with over 24 tribes already. And those projects, and it is the different levels of engagement depending on the needs of the tribe, but in that group of projects, there's 3 gigawatts of solar that stands to be developed.
How fantastic. Right. How many tribes are there? Is that a simple question?
Yeah, there's 500. Presently, there's 574 federally recognized tribes. There's hundreds more that have state recognition or are not recognized. But yeah. Right now, there's 574.
And they're all eligible for all this IRA funding.
Yes.
Your organization has a guiding principle that I don't know if I can pronounce. Etwapmunk.
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 Yeah, you did a good job.
Etwapmunk, and that's about two-eyed seeing. Okay. Describe that principle, please.
Yeah. My ancestors realized that, as we were talking about earlier, when the settlers came, that if they didn't find a way to work together, that there would be problems. Translated to English, Etwapmunk means two-eyed seeing. And that literally means the willingness to see from one eye the strengths of indigenous wisdom and knowledge, and from the other, the strengths of Western knowledge and technology. And, you know, since first contact, my ancestors applied this to daily life because, you know, they recognized if we're going to have successful and beneficial relationships rather than conflict, that we must espouse that attitude of cooperation and respect for different perspectives, both for survival and to protect the earth. And our organization really embodies this way of thinking in the way that we're a team of indigenous and non-indigenous people, that we're united in our beliefs, in our desire to support the self-determination and sovereignty of Native American nations. And by even the non-natives among us, our collective understanding that traditional indigenous knowledge and ways of knowing have had profound and long established positive impacts on our planet. And, you know, the value of collaboration and the appreciation of differences is important if we're going to succeed at halting climate change. And many of our tribal nations feel that, you know, they're on a path to extinction because, yeah. And that's a tough word, right? Yeah. Extinction, you think about plants and animals, you don't think about humans, but many tribes are dwindling, the numbers are dwindling, and the impacts of climate change on the planet and on economies is devastating. And this represents hope, you know, yeah. It really does. And young people on reservations that are that don't see a future, when we come and show them that, you know, here's a job that you can do right in your own community, that's in line with native ethos and life ways. You don't have to go, you don't have to leave the res. You don't have to, you can stay here and build this infrastructure with your fellow tribal members. You can learn a skill and have well-paying jobs and be proud of the work you do. And so many struggled with working in coal mines and working in coal plants because it paid the bills, but it was completely, you know, flew in the face of their belief systems.
Yeah. Boy, yeah. Oh boy. Boy, Sherry, thank you so much for your time today and for what you're doing. And you are the perfect person to be leading that charge. I know, I can see, and you're having that background, that ancestry that does combine those two sets of perspectives. So thanks so much. Yeah, great to meet you.
Yeah, great to meet you. Thank you so much. I look forward to working with you out in the field.
Good stuff. Have a great day. That's it. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Flanagan's Ecologic. We'll see you next time.